From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Across the Moors by William Fryer Harvey. It really was most unfortunate. Peggy had a temperature of nearly 100 and a pain in her side, and Mrs. Workington Bancroft knew that it was appendicitis. But there was no one whom she could send for the doctor. James had gone with a jaunting car to meet her husband, who had at last managed to get away for a week's shooting. Adolf she had sent to the Evershams only half an hour before with a note for Lady Eva. The cook could not manage to walk, even if dinner could be served without her. Kate, as usual, was not to be trusted. There remained Miss Craig. "Of course, you must see that Peggy is really ill," said she, as the governess came into the room in answer to her summons. "The difficulty is, there is absolutely no one whom I can send for the doctor." Mrs. Workington Bancroft paused. She was always willing that those beneath her should have the privilege of offering the services which it was her right to command. "So perhaps, Miss Craig," she went on, "you would not mind walking over to Debbett's farm. I hear there's a Liverpool doctor staying there. Of course, I know nothing about him, but we must take the risk, and I expect he'll only be too glad to be earning something during his holiday. It's nearly 4 miles, I know, and I'd never dream of asking you if it were not that I dread appendicitis so." "Very well," said Miss Craig. "I suppose I must go, but I don't know the way." "Oh, you can't miss it," said Mrs. Workington Bancroft, in her anxiety temporarily forgiving the obvious unwillingness of her governess' consent. "You follow the road across the moor for 2 miles, until you come to Red Man's Cross. You turn to the left there, and follow a rough path that leads through a large plantation, and Tebbett's farms lies just below you in the valley. And take Pontiff with you," she added, as the girl left the room. "There's absolutely nothing to be afraid of, but I expect you'll feel happier with the dog." "Well, miss," said the cook, when Miss Craig went into the kitchen to get her boots, which had been drying by the fire, "of course she knows best. But I don't think it's right, after all that's happened, for the mistress to send you across the moors on a night like this. It's not as if the doctor could do anything for Miss Margaret if you do bring him. Every child is like that once in a while. He only say, 'Put her to bed,' and she's already there." "I don't see what there is to be afraid of, cook," said Miss Craig as she laced her boots, "unless you believe in ghosts." "I'm not so sure about that. Anyhow, I don't like sleeping in a bed where the sheets are too short for you to pull them over your head. But don't you be frightened, miss. It's my belief that their bark is worse than their bite." But though Miss Craig amused herself for some minutes by trying to imagine the bark of a ghost, a thing altogether different from the classical ghostly bark, she did not feel entirely at her ease. She was naturally nervous, and living as she did in the hinterland of the servants' hall, she had heard vague details of true stories that were only myths in the drawing-room. The very name of Red Man's Cross sent a shiver through her. It must have been the place where that horrid murder was committed. She had forgotten the tale, though she remembered the name. Her first disaster came soon enough. Pontiff, who was naturally slow-witted, took more than 5 minutes to find out that it was only the governess he was escorting. But once the discovery had been made, he promptly turned tail, paying not the slightest heed to Miss Craig's feeble whistle. And then, to add to her discomfort, the rain came, not in heavy drops, but driving in sheets of thin spray that blotted out what few landmarks there were upon the moor. They were very kind at Tebbett's farm,
the doctor had gone back to Liverpool the day before, but Mrs. Tebbets gave her hot milk and turf cakes and offered her reluctant son to show Miss Craig a shorter path onto the moor that avoided the larch wood. He was a monosyllabic youth, but his presence was cheering, and she felt the night doubly black when he left her at the last gate. She trudged on wearily. Her thoughts had already gone back to the almost exhausted theme of the bark of ghosts, when she heard steps on the road behind her that were at least material. Next minute, the figure of a man appeared. Miss Craig was relieved to see that the stranger was a clergyman. He raised his hat. "I believe we are both going in the same direction," he said. "Perhaps I may have the pleasure of escorting you." She thanked him. "It is rather weird at night," she went on, "and what with all the tales of ghosts and bogies that one hears from the country people, I've ended by being half afraid myself." "I can understand you're nervous," he said, "especially on a night like this. I used that one time to feel the same, for my work often meant lonely walks across the moor to farms, which were only reached by rough tracks, difficult enough to find even in the daytime." "And you never saw anything to frighten you? Nothing immaterial, I mean." "I can't really say that I did, but I had an experience 11 years ago which served as a turning point in my life, and since you seem to be now in much the same state of mind as I was then in, I will tell it. The time of year was late September. I had been over to Westendale to see an old woman who was dying, and then just as I was about to start on my way home, word came to me of another of my parishioners who had been suddenly taken ill only that morning. It was after 7 when at last I started. A farmer saw me on my way, turning back when I reached the moor road. The sunset the previous evening had been one of the most lovely I ever remember seeing. The whole vault of heaven had been scattered with flakes of white cloud, tipped with rosy pink like the strewn petals of a full-blown rose. But that night all was changed. The sky was an absolutely dull slate color, except in one corner of the west, where a thin rift showed the last saffron tint of the sullen sunset. As I walked stiff and footsore, my spirit sank. It must have been the marked contrast between the two evenings, the one so lovely, so full of promise. The corn was still out in the fields, spoiling for fine weather. The other so gloomy, so sad with all the dead weight of autumn and winter days to come. And then, added to the sense of heavy depression, came another different feeling which I surprised myself by recognizing as fear. I did not know why I was afraid. The moors lay on either side of me, unbroken except for a straggling line of turf, shooting butts that stood within a stone's throw of the road. The only sound I had heard for the last half hour was the cry of the startled grouse. "Go back, go back, go back." But yet the feeling of fear was there, affecting a low center of my brain through some little used physical channel. I buttoned my coat closer and tried to divert my thoughts by thinking of next Sunday's sermon. I'd chosen to preach on Job. There's much in the old-fashioned notion of the book, apart from all the subtleties of the higher criticism, that appeals to country people. The loss of herds and crop, the breakup of the family. I would not have dared to speak, had not I too been a farmer. My own glebe land had been flooded 3 weeks before, and I suppose I stood to lose as much as any man in the parish. As I walked along the road, repeating to myself the first chapter of the book, I stopped at the 12th verse. "And the Lord said unto Satan, Behold, all that he hath is in thy power." The thought of the bad harvest, and that is an awful thought in these valleys, vanished. I seemed to gaze into an ocean of infinite darkness. I've often used, with the Sunday glibness of the tired priest, whose duty it is to preach 3 sermons in one day, the old simile of the chessboard. God and the devil were the players, and we were helping one side or the other. But until that night, I had not thought of the possibility of my being only a pawn in the game, that God might throw away, that the game might be won. I had reached the place where we are now. I remember it by that rough stone water trough, when a man suddenly jumped up from the roadside. He had been sitting on a heap of broken road metal. "Which way are you going, Governor?" he said. I knew from the way he spoke that the man was a stranger. There are many of this time of the year who come up from the south, tramping northwards with the ripening corn. I told him my destination. "We'll be going along together," he replied. It was too dark to see much of the man's face, but what little I made out was coarse and brutal. Then he began the half-menacing whine I knew so well. He had tramped miles that day. He had had no food since breakfast, and that was only a crust. "Give us a copper," he said. "It's only for a night's lodging." He was whittling away with a big clasp knife at an ash stake he had taken from some hedge. The clergyman broke off. "Are those the lights of your house?" he said. "We are nearer than I expected, but I shall have time to finish my story. I think I will, for you can run home in a couple of minutes, and I don't want you to be frightened when you are out on the moors again." As the man talked, he seemed to have stepped out of the very background of my thoughts, his sordid tale with the sad lies that hid a far sadder truth. He asked me the time. It was 9:05. As I replaced my watch, I glanced at his face. His teeth were clenched. There was something in the gleam of his eyes that told me at once his purpose. "Have you ever known how long a second is?" For a third of a second, I stood there facing him, filled with an overwhelming pity for myself and him. And then, without a word of warning, he was upon me. I felt nothing. A flash of lightning ran down my spine. I heard the dull crash of the ash stake, and then a very gentle patter, like the sound of a far-distant stream. For a minute, I lay in perfect happiness, watching the lights of the house as they increased in number until the whole heaven shone with twinkling lamps. I could not have had a more painless death. Miss Craig looked up. The man was gone. She was alone on the moor. She ran to the house, her teeth chattering, ran to the solid shadow that crossed and recrossed the kitchen blind. As she entered the hall, the clock on the stairs struck the hour. It was 9:00. Attorney for the Dam by Rainier Wires. Camberton knew by the muffled ring which of his two telephones to pick up. Yet he hesitated. Who could be calling him at this late hour on this secret, unlisted wire? Only 6 of his underworld clients knew the number. 2 of these gentlemen of doubtful integrity had just gone out the door. 2 were in Europe, and 1 in prison. The 6th was Burke Cotton. But Burke Cotton was dead. The muffled bell rang again. Camberton's pudgy hand closed on the cradled instrument and lifted it to his ear. He said nothing. He never spoke first on this line. Whoever knew the number of it was expected to know also the code word, which had to be uttered before Camberton would respond. Presently the word came, "Reference room." It was spoken in low, unfamiliar tones. "Who are you?" rasped Camberton. His round, pasty face was an expressionless mask, save for the glint of suspicion in his beady, fat-encircled eyes. "A friend of Houghton's," the unknown whispered. "He gave me this number. Said for me to call it when I'm in a jam." "What's your name?"
"Smith. John Smith."
"Very unusual," sneered Camberton. "I've never heard it before. I don't know you."
"Wait. You'll know me when you see me."
"Why should I see you?"
"Because I've got plenty of money for legal advice."
"Are you alone?"
"Yes, I am," drawled Camberton in a bored tone, which was belied by the greed in his piggish eyes.
"Do you know how to get here?"
"I know everything about you that Houghton knew. I'll come up the back way like he always did. I'll be there in 10 minutes. Horace L. Camberton. Criminal lawyer, any way you say it. Put down the telephone, leaned back in his chair and looked again at the newspaper item, which he had been reading before the interruption. Early that morning, according to the item, Burke Cotton and two Confederates were shot to death while looting the First Industrial Bank of Willow Ridge, a southwestern suburb of Chicago. Houghton's corpse was identified by the police. The other two had apparently been crime recruits. Their names were as yet unknown. Camberton's only pang of regret on reading the item was in his purse. Houghton had been a well-paying client, and although he had not required legal counsel during the past year, he would have, sooner or later, had he not been mowed down. Perhaps, reflected the attorney, this stranger who had just telephoned would take the place of the dear departed as a source of revenue. However, one couldn't be too sure. It was best to prepare for any kind of a comer. From his library table, Camberton transferred a loaded revolver to his right-hand coat pocket. Then he went into the bedchamber and opened the top drawer of his bureau. From this he took another loaded pistol, which he dropped into his left-hand pocket. He waddled impatiently back and forth in the two rooms which comprised his suite in the Avon Arms Hotel, a receivership skyscraper towering in Diversey Parkway east of Clark Street. It was a nest of shysters, racketeers, and elegantly clad hoodlums. Ordinarily, he felt perfectly at home in this environment, in the shadow of the Double Cross, but tonight he was uneasy. Never before had he been so apprehensive of impending trouble as he was now, while awaiting his nocturnal visitor. Rather than be called upon to open the door and find himself only several inches from his guest, he released the latch, backed across the room, and sat down on a straight-backed chair. Facing the entrance, each of his clammy hands was plunged into a pocket, gripping a gun. Now, he thought, if I don't like your looks, Mr. Smith, or whoever, or whatever you are, I'll make you back right out again. Nobody's going to pull a fast one on little Horace. The knocking he presently heard was stealthy, almost inaudible, but loud and blustering was his response to it. Come in, he shouted. The door opened silently. A man whose broad shoulders and muscular arms bulged visibly under his tightly draped jacket stepped in and closed the door behind him. His right hand remained in his pocket as though he too was grasping a weapon. With his other hand, he tilted the dip-brimmed summer felt hat back from his forehead. Dernack! Exclaimed Camberton, jumping to his feet. There was no mistaking the name of this visitor. His face was pictured almost daily in the newspaper. He was Anton Tony Dernack, widely publicized as America's public enemy number one. So you do know me, after all, the stranger grunted, defiantly jutting out his jaw. And you know there's a reward of 25 grand on my hide. But, his pocketed hand lifted the coat slightly, don't think you'll collect it. Besides, I can more than double the ante if you'll work on my side. Camberton's fat, greedy face broke into an oily grimace, which he believed was a cordial smile. Let's be friends, he said, extending a welcoming hand. Dernack grinned out of the side of his mouth as he grasped the lawyer's flabby fingers in his own ham-like fist. Okay, now you're my mouthpiece, and you better be a good one. That's what I need. You need a drink too, my boy. The two men sat down facing each other and talked. That is to say, Dernack talked. Camberton merely listened and watched his guest down one drink after another from the whiskey bottle, which the lawyer had placed on a convenient magazine table. Camberton, at the same time, simulated just a proper degree of sympathetic understanding. He was adept at it. It was in this way that he came to know so many things which necessitated such undercover equipment as the secret telephone. Dernack, the hunted, seemed eager to unburden himself to the attorney. For all his bulk and reputation as a hard hombre, he was plainly frightened. He had achieved too much notoriety for his peace of mind.
Having lived by the gun, he apparently feared death by the gun. Every man's hand was against him. He poured himself yet another drink and said, "I met Houghton in Minneapolis about 6 months ago. He joined my gang and we did several jobs. Payroll raids in St. Louis. The last one there wasn't so good. 3 of my boys were killed." "I remember reading about that," remarked Camberton. "But I didn't know that Houghton was there, or you either." "Nobody knows it now. Houghton and the other 2 were killed this morning." The bandit licked his lips. "I almost went along, but I had a hunch. Besides, why should I take any chances when I've got more than 100 grand salted away? Part of it was Houghton's, but he's dead. The rest of the mob that ain't dead is in jail. So there's nobody left to split with, excepting you. How much will it cost me to get out of the country?" Camberton's porcine eyes narrowed as he looked at his visitor. Was it really possible for such a hulking lout to retain so much loot? Would he give up half, 3/4 of it to save his skin? The attorney was confident that both questions could be answered in the affirmative. "It'll be a hard job," he said. "Your picture, given to the police by that dame you ditched, is being printed so often nowadays that your face is as well known as Babe Ruth's. Your mug and the description are posted in every police chief's office, and every detective bureau and agency in the country, and in every post office. That's just it. Even people who only look like me are getting arrested and shot at," cried Durnack. "What chance have I got?" "A good chance," said Camberton, watching his client closely. "But, as I said, it'll be a hard job. And expensive. There will be certain preliminary costs. First of all, I'd have to hire someone to do a little plastic surgery on that well-known face of yours. Then, too, I'd have to pay for fixing aids along the route you take. And..." "Hell!" exclaimed Dermack. "If you're worried about my being able to pay, here's 25 grand for a starter." He reached into his breast pocket and tossed a packet of greenbacks into the attorney's lap. "And remember, there's more than 100 grand where that came from. It's all safe and snug under the floor of the Ideal Shoe Repair Shop, just a few blocks from here." He hiccuped. Then, loosening his tongue with another drink of whiskey, he rambled on. "Yeah, I own the Ideal Shoe Repair Shop. The old shoemaker who's supposed to own it is just a stooge for me. He learned cobbling in the penitentiary." "Does he know the money's there?" "Haha, not much. Old Fred Miller's too dumb to ever know anything important. All he knows is that I sometimes use the joint for business meetings with Houghton and the boys. I was sent Miller out with enough money to get drunk on. Other time he sleeps there. I chased him out tonight, figuring that me and you might take a walk over there after a while and settle our deal." Mere slits now. The criminal lawyer's greedy eyes flashed from the money to Durnack. Camberton thought fast. How much money would it be worth to risk disbarment, perhaps prison, if anything went wrong in smuggling his client out of the United States? The problem caused a frown to crease his round, bland face. Like a flash, an easy solution suggested itself. He leered sinisterly at Durnack. Startled, the fugitive reached for his gun, but the lawyer, with a speed surprising one so fat and flabby, whipped out his own pistol and fired before the other one could take aim. Public enemy number 1 toppled from his chair, a bullet in his head. With a deep breath of satisfaction, inhaling a whiff of gunpowder smoke, Camberton noted that his victim's lifeless hand still held a revolver. It would make the story of self-defense more dramatic. He arose, hurriedly put the packet of greenbacks in the wall safe, leaving the door open, cleared away the whiskey and glasses, and then picked up the telephone, the one connected with a hotel switchboard. "Send for the police," he said calmly. "I've just shot a burglar. He looks like Tony Durnack." Police officers, reporters, and hotel employees, crowding into the suite a few moments later, heard his thrilling narrative of how, upon returning from a stroll, he had caught Durnack in the act of ransacking the wall safe. "He rushed at me.
His gun leveled at my heart, but I was quicker on the trigger. "Ever see him before?" asked the police sergeant. "Never. My guess as to his identity was based on press pictures I've seen."
"Gosh, Mr. Camberton," blurted one of the reporters, "you'll get the $25,000 reward."
"That's so. I hadn't thought of it. I was merely trying to protect my life and property. I'll agree that perhaps I do deserve some reward for having rid society of a dangerous killer." Highly pleased with himself, the lawyer then posed for innumerable newspaper photographs. He posed, pointing his gun at the camera, pointing his finger at the wall safe, shaking hands with the sergeant, shaking hands with the hotel manager, with bellhops, with chambermaids, with almost everyone excepting his dead victim. He obliged the cameraman willingly, refusing only the request of one who wanted him to stand with one foot resting on the corpse, in the manner of a big game hunter. This, the attorney declared, would be beneath his dignity. Not until the dark hour just before the dawn was he left alone. Excitedly he turned the leaves of his telephone directory, seeing the address of the ideal shoe repair shop. Here it was, 692 Elwell Court, less than 4 blocks away. He patted the revolvers in his pocket, took an electric torch from his bureau, put on his hat, and went out, leaving the building by a rear stairway. Although only a few blocks from the brightly lighted corner of Clark and Broadway, Elwell Court was a shabby little side street of dismal frame shanties. Bleakest of these was number 692, with shoe repairing crudely lettered on the glass of the front door. It was hardly a place you would suspect of being the depository of $100,000 in cash. Camberton, however, was confident that he would find this sum. He knew his crooks, and had correctly judged Dernack as a simpleton that he was. The fool had even put a modern lock on the door. Camberton's skeleton key opened it easily. Inside, he observed that the weakened rays of a distant street lamp penetrated the grimy front windows just enough to cast a dim and eerie light, blocked out there and here by machinery and furnishings which cast grotesque and misleading shadows. Feeling his way, he stepped forward. His shin encountered something in the dark, something that sprang through the air with a hissing, spitting sound. Two yellow eyes glared balefully at him. He flashed his torch at it and cursed under his breath as the cat arched its back in the glare. He threw the beam around the room to get his bearings. There was a door at the rear of the shop. Camberton regarded it apprehensively as he put out the light. What if old Miller, who according to Dernack sometimes slept in the rear of the shop, had returned? The lawyer decided to look into that back room before searching the loot. Tiptoeing forward, he placed his hand on the doorknob. As he turned it, slowly and silently, a strange fear gripped him. It was unusual, for though he was not the bravest man in the world, he was certainly not one to be frightened by darkness and the angrily gleaming eyes of a cat. The touch of terror was caused by something else. He knew not what. It angered him. Forgetting his caution, he jerked the door open. An icy draft swept around him, enveloping him so completely that he shivered with intense cold. There was something wrong about this, too. This chill on a warm July night. It required all his willpower to stop the quivering of his fatty flesh as he stared into the room. It was better lighted than the other. The illumination which streamed through the window came from the rear porch light of a house next door. Camberton's nervous scrutiny sweeping the room was halted and held by an object in the darkest corner. It seemed to be the figure of a man lying on a cot. So, that old cobbler Miller had come back to sleep off his drunkenness here. But the odor that assailed Camberton's nostrils was not of alcohol. It was of something equally familiar. Something that did not belong here. Sniffing to clear his nostrils, and at the same time firmly grasping his revolver, Camberton started to slink forward towards the recumbent form, then stood stock still, wide-eyed with fright. The figure on the cot was sitting up, and it wasn't the figure of an old man. It was the husky, broad-shouldered figure of Tony Dernack,
America's public enemy number one. Tony Dernack, whose corpse, at this moment, should be stretched on a slab in the county morgue, was sitting up. The face of the figure seemed to gleam with a greenish phosphorescent light, making more horrible the vilipending leer that was directed at the horrified attorney. In the forehead of the face was a bullet hole, and the odor that was creeping into Camberton's brain was the odor of burnt gunpowder. His round countenance paled to sickly white, his eyes almost popped out of their thick fleshy pouches. He moved his lips, but could not utter a sound. "You," he managed to croak at last, "you! Why, damn you, Dernack, I killed you once, and I'll kill you again." He aimed his pistol at the apparition. The shanty seemed to shake as the gun roared again and again. The spurts of gunfire seemed to pierce right through the figure, which rose slowly from the cot and moved relentlessly towards Camberton step by step. The lawyer backed away from it, firing desperately. Try as he might, he could not turn and run. The eyes staring into his with a hypnotic fixedness seemed to fasten his own with invisible bands, permitting him to step back only as far as the other had stepped forward, no further. Sobbing wildly, Camberton pulled out his other gun and emptied its contents at the wraith. Automatically, his twitching fingers jerked at the triggers of the emptied weapons, clicking them futilely. That was the way the police squad crew found him. Idiotically, clicking the triggers of two empty guns. The shooting had aroused the neighborhood and brought the prowl car to number 692 within 3 minutes of the first crack of the first gun. The lifeless body of old Fred Miller, riddled with the bullets from the attorney's pistols, lay on the cot. That was all that the police saw. That, and the drooling madman who had once been Horace G. Camberton, well-known criminal attorney, pressing the revolver trigger like an automaton. It is hardly likely that he will ever be tried for the murder of the aged shoemaker, because he does not seem able to comprehend what he's done. In an asylum for the criminal insane, he crouches in his cell, insisting that he and Dernack were the only occupants of the back room at number 692. Few people are permitted to visit the broken attorney. Fewer care to do so, since, as the authority explained it, the mad terror which creeps over his face at intervals is of such awfulness that the most hardened observers shudder at the sight of it. The intervals are becoming more and more frequent, and should the apparent suffering he experiences in these intervals become a permanent mental condition, it will not be necessary to punish Horace L. Camberton further for his crimes.